For years, we just used to tell women to Kegel. But now, as we see a higher prevalence of women who are affected by chronic stress, who have underlying symptoms of depression or anxiety, or just have a natural tendency towards a higher muscle tone, things like Kegels are not an appropriate exercise.
Welcome to the Anthropology Podcast. I'm your host, Megan Walker. As a former naturopathic doctor and anthropologist, I align the intersection of personal performance, purpose, and innovative thinking in badass women working to change the world as entrepreneurs and go-getters. Anthropology is the study and science of what makes an entrepreneur think, feel, and perform in a path compelled by a vision for helping others, solving problems, while building a life on your own terms. Together, we are exploring the health, mindset, and strategies that distinguish the world's best entrepreneurs. This is the Anthropology Podcast. Welcome to episode 217 of the Anthropology Podcast. I'm so excited that you are joining me today, and we have a really important conversation. And I want to qualify this conversation as we jump in. I am joined by my friend Melanie Sutherland. Melanie is a pelvic floor physiotherapist. She is an entrepreneur, a mother, and an incredible advocate of women's health. And what we're talking about today are the things we wish women knew before they had a baby to optimize their health and optimize their capacity to execute in the world on the other side of motherhood. And traditionally, one of the biggest challenges in healthcare, and especially for those of us who are passionate about upstream preventative health, is that we've been trained by a healthcare system to be reactionary about health. We wait till the problem arises and then we deal with it. And when it comes to the changes that take place in a woman's body in that prenatal phase and how that influences health on the other side, there are some key elements that you need to be aware of in order to maximize that next phase of life. This is what Melanie and I are delving into today. It's a powerful and important conversation, and I'm so excited for you to have the opportunity to join in and meet Melanie as well. Melanie Sutherland, welcome to the Anthropology Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Megan. I'm excited to be here.
Well, this is going to be such a critical conversation, and what we're getting into, I'm going to let everyone know right off the bat. So the gentlemen who are like, all right, let's go. It's episode 217. I just want you to know we're talking about prenatal health. So if that's where you're at in your stage with your family, then hang out with us. But we're going to have this conversation as clinicians. We're going to have it as parents. We're going to have this as entrepreneurs. What is it that every woman needs to know before they have their babies so that their body is in the best possible shape on the other side? And Melanie, I want to, before we open that conversation, for you to share with everyone what makes you so uniquely qualified to lead this discussion today.
Thanks, Megan. I appreciate that. So really, it's interesting. My practice has always sort of imitated life. And in my particular case, I grew my business when I had just had one baby, and then I really worked to scale it with my second one. And I had this really different experience. When I had my daughter, I was a high-risk pregnancy. And so I had all these conversations with people around all of the things that I couldn't do. I'm a cervical cancer survivor, and when I was going through this pregnancy with her, everything was deemed high risk. So I was always really high stress. What is the impact of the baby? All of this stuff. I came out the other side of that, and I was in a very corporate environment where my boss said, I want you back in 6 weeks. And initially I thought that over. But when I got to that 6 week part, my body, my stress level, all of that was not ready to go back to a corporate job. And so actually I did one of the most freeing things I ever did in my life was I said goodbye to my corporate job, goodbye to the corporate salary, the security, all of that, because I knew my body and my brain, A, weren't in the position for it, and B, it wasn't an example that I also wanted to set for my daughter. So, you know, I did the crazy thing. I actually started my own business because I don't know. I thought that would be easier.
Yeah, it's way easier.
So much easier, right?
I wish you could see our sarcastic faces right now.
My gosh. But you know what? I really did it with the thought process in mind that I knew there would be challenges. I knew there would be a learning curve, but I really believed that in having my own business, I would have time freedom and I could do things on my own terms. What I didn't realize was because I had spent so much of my time and so much of my pregnancy worrying about the baby and not focusing on myself, not setting those foundational health parameters and wellness parameters, is that it was really, really hard. My wellness and my stress level were not at a point that made it an easy task to do. So fast forward 3 years from there, and I got pregnant with my son. And this time around, I stopped asking all of the questions about what I couldn't do, and I started asking the questions about what I can do. And so I challenged my body and I challenged my mindfulness in a way that I hadn't with my first pregnancy. And what resulted was much better outcomes in terms of healing. I actually scaled my business quite a bit when I had my second child with much less stress, much better strategy. It's still growing and building. But what I see in women today and what I see in so many of the mothers in my practice is that they're so focused on the outcome of baby that they stop thinking about the outcome as mothers. And the challenge with that philosophy is when we don't prepare ourselves as mothers, we lend ourselves to a really rocky transition into motherhood. And especially as first-time moms, if you're not prepared for that, if you're not prepared for the challenges of it, anything you want to do external to motherhood becomes really challenging.
Yeah, it's so fascinating because I remember my mom saying this to me when I was pregnant with my first. She's like, watch, like they're going to care for you under the context of caring for the baby. And the second you give birth to that baby, you are like cast aside, like your role in the life cycle is over. And she didn't feel that way about obviously my role, but she was like, I just want you to be prepared psychologically because it's going to be the very first time in your life where suddenly you're not going to be the one that everyone wants to care for. You are like second fiddle and you can't go back. And it's so interesting because I do feel like, one, it is such a busy phase. And the second the term high risk is thrown around, we are just focused on the baby. We're not talking about our pelvic floor. We're not talking about other things that actually are gateways to us being able to reclaim some sense of normalcy. And then we give birth the very first time. And yes, it is all about the baby. And if you're not prepared for that piece too, it further reinforces this belief that like, oh, I actually really don't matter anymore. And I find so many women get locked in that. Like, I'd love to go to the gym, but honestly, like, what is it? What does it matter?
Yeah, I say that to all the women that we coach through this process, because if we don't start to prioritize ourselves as part of the prenatal experience, we set a standard moving forward, right? And then we're at the bottom of the heap, and it's so true. And we always joke in our practice that 6 week, I don't even know why we have a 6 week appointment, but it's like the medical system is saying, bye-bye, you're on your own, good luck. We know physiologically, most of us aren't even healed at that point. And it's true. All of a sudden, this support melts away from mothers. And you know, when your only role at that point in time is defined by motherhood and you want to do other things and you don't have the support for that and you don't know, is this normal? Is it not normal? That becomes really, really challenging.
Tell us a little bit as a clinician. I mean, you are practicing, well, recently retired, but still run the practice, physiotherapist with a focus in your practice on pelvic floor rehabilitation. Like, what are the common narratives that you are seeing with women in their practice? And what are some of the common things you're seeing in terms of challenges to their pelvic floor and to their rehabilitation as a result of those beliefs?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say the bulk of the women I see, and we're changing this narrative, it's getting better for sure. But what was unusual when I started my practice was I wasn't seeing the brand new moms. We're seeing more of them now, but what I was seeing is these women who were 5-10 years after they delivered, and they were coming in with all of these issues. And so they were issues of incontinence, issues of painful periods, painful sex, back pain, things that fundamentally change how we participate in our life. And they were actually complaining of them for, in some cases, literally decades afterwards. And they never knew that there was an option for them to be otherwise. So the biggest problem is when these women don't see the need to actually have these conversations, to ask these questions, to prioritize themselves. What they inadvertently do without realizing is they take themselves out of opportunities. They take themselves out of meaningful participation. And you know, it's a really powerful experience when we see some of these women like 10 years down the road. And there's a box of tissues in all of our offices here because inevitably somebody says, oh my God, I have been afraid to participate in, you know, this activity because I was so afraid I was going to have a leak. Or, you know, I didn't go for that big job promotion because I wasn't sure if my body could handle it with all these symptoms. And then we tell them that they were fixable and like the tears just start to come down because they realize they've missed out on 10, 15 years of their life because they didn't have a conversation about something that was very fixable.
And I think the conversation so many people have with their practitioners is, oh, that's common. Lots of women go through that. I really do feel like only recently are we starting to see this shift in conversation of care providers for women in that perinatal state where they're like, you should consider going to see a pelvic floor physio. You should consider caring for yourself after you have a baby. And this notion of common and normal are not the same thing. So what do we need to know in that prenatal phase? Like, what can we be doing? I'm sure there's psychological prompts that we can be aware of, and we started to talk about that, but like, what do we need to be doing to make sure that our body is in the best possible shape?
Yeah, that is a great question. And we often look at a bunch of different things. We look at how we're moving our bodies. We look at how we're fueling our bodies. We look at simple lifestyle hacks, simple things that we would do on a day-to-day basis, which have big impact on how our bodies are performing from a mechanical standpoint, from an ability to have resilience to stress. We look at mindfulness. It's really interesting that so many of our clients just assume that they're going to have a very weak pelvic floor and it's going to lead to incontinence. And overwhelmingly, what we're seeing is that people actually have tight pelvic floors. And we know that there's a really strong correlation between anxiety, depression, and stress and tight pelvic floors. So people who don't have that mindfulness component, or people whose nervous system are really built up and it's firing a lot higher than it should be, are at risk for all these other symptoms. So we really talk about how we can downregulate that nervous system as part of the conversation as well. And you know, all of these things are really useful as part of the pregnancy perspective. It makes pregnancy more comfortable. It prepares you for labor and delivery, but probably what it does most is it optimizes recovery and it puts you in a great position for that transition into motherhood. I always like to use the analogy of a marathon. You would never go into a marathon without training for it, right? Everybody knows that's just a really bad idea.
It's a terrible idea.
Terrible idea. You wouldn't even consider it. But what we don't do is afford motherhood and labor and delivery that same status. And so women go into it vastly unprepared and then wonder like why their bodies are tired, why their stress levels are through the roof, why they don't sort of have the energy and the vitality to go after things that were really meaningful to them before. Mm-hmm. And it's because they didn't train their body and their mind for it ahead of time.
And it's an interesting conversation because I feel like so much of how we have been trained to experience our health is reactionary. You get sick, you go to the doctor. Even from a prenatal perspective, people are like, oh, I got pregnant. Now I need to go find my midwife, or I need to go find my obstetrician. Our whole engagement with health is from this reactionary perspective. And there's always going to be a significant number of people who are like, I'm just going to walk in and hope for the best. I don't want the anxiety of planning for it. And you know, as fellow parental sisters, we'll like help you on the other side, because that's not going to go the way you're hoping for. But a huge part of it is like creating that necessity in that prenatal phase for people to want to take action. Can we just talk a little bit about outcomes to baby when women make that decision to actually prioritize their own health and their pelvic floor and their recovery and all of these elements before the birth happens?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think people always think that they're making the decision to do something for baby, but when we don't look after ourselves, we actually aren't acting in the best interest of babies. Most of the maternal studies have shown that when mothers keep themselves in good health, whether it's physically or mentally, the outcomes for baby on the other side of that are amazing. For example, birth weight is a big one. We actually see that mothers who have good movement patterns, who are well-fueled, are also showing that they're having better birth weight outcomes, which is a great one. Another one that we're seeing is a decrease in premature births for baby. And you know, if you know anything about skin-to-skin connection, we also know that babies on the other side of that, when they're born, are kind of like little thermometers of what mom's health is like. And it was really interesting. After I had my daughter, she ended up being an emergency induction. For those of you who are in Toronto, she was born in the dead of that ice storm we had 7 years ago at Sunnybrook with no power. And I think because my health was so ill-equipped for this, my blood pressure shot way, way up, like scary for somebody who's generally in good health. It was numbers that I'd never seen before. And we just assumed that would come down afterwards, but it didn't. And so the doctors started saying, oh, maybe you need to go on blood pressure medication. And I just had a really high firing nervous system. And so it was interesting. I remember going to a prenatal or a postnatal appointment, and the doctor said to me, okay, come on in, everything. Baby was screaming at the top of her lungs. Like absolutely just screaming, could not be calmed. The doctor suggested I take baby out of the room and I actually leave her with my mom, because in those days you could bring somebody to appointment and do that.
Back in the day.
Anyhow, she had me come in and just do some deep breathing, which for anybody who thinks of that as a prescription thinks it's like the least sexy thing to do for health, but it's so important. And she just had me do some deep breathing and just in a calm environment, and then brought baby back in skin to skin. All of a sudden, baby's temperament changed drastically. Think of how much easier it would be to accomplish things, to feel good about yourself, if you had a baby that was reflective of you being in those states. And that's what we see. Women who manage their stress well, women who have good heart rate variability, also have calmer babies. We know that babies feel that blood pressure change, that temperature change, all of that's been echoed in the skin to skin or kangaroo care studies. So a mom who's healthy is generally also going to have a baby who's more tolerable of change, who has better resiliency to change an environment because mom is calm too.
Physiological resilience is such a power move when it comes to your health. And it's interesting because we've had this conversation with a variety of different guests, and I just want to acknowledge the undercurrent in all of these varied conversations. So whether we're overtly talking about resilience, whether we're talking about brain health, whether we're talking about things, you know, on a pathology side, and in this case, you know, caring for mothers, this notion of physiological resilience. And for people, I'm obviously not talking to you right now, Melanie, I'm talking to those people who are part of our community, but this idea of physiological resilience when it comes to, you know, I can eat something sweet and I'm not in a diabetic coma. I can have a little bit of gluten, assuming you're not celiac, I can have a little bit of gluten and it's not catastrophic. These are examples of physiological resilience. And while there are situations where we are more sensitized to our environment, I really want everyone to just acknowledge that again is common. It's not normal. So I don't want anyone, Melanie doesn't want anyone living in a bubble of no stress and no negative food influence. Like part of health is that you can be in environments of increased stress, whether that is food consumption or emotional stress, and your physiology doesn't fall apart as a result of that pressure. It should be one of the metrics that you're looking at when we're talking about that evolution of health. So I love that you shared that story, but it's so key.
Yeah. And I think, you know, let's face it, stress and burnout are the undercurrent of everything right now.
Yes.
But every time we make a decision that takes our body away from wellness, what we do is we decrease our ability to manage that stress. And what I say to moms is there's probably no more stressful situation than being a brand new mom and like given this life to take from the hospital. It is yours. You are all of a sudden in charge of another human being. But if you haven't taken the steps to make sure that your body and your brain are healthy, your ability to manage that stress is going to be directly proportional to your state of health. So it's really important that we start to get that in, as you say, before it's too late. And I mean, nothing is ever too late, but if it's an afterthought, it's so much harder under those circumstances to get your feet under you again. If we start to have these discussions early on before the stress is present, women are so much better equipped to manage that. And that's, I mean, that goes for everything, not just motherhood, but we need to start thinking of things before we're in a situation of do or die.
Totally. I'm just thinking as, you know, you're talking about how you left that corporate job. Like if you're the kind of person who you get frustrated, you're like you just fantasize about not having to deal with that boss. You're like, I just have to shut them off. I'm just going to shut my phone off to get away from them. I just want you to know that when your kids trigger you the same way, there's no off button. There is zero boundary. And I think that is the part, it's the zero boundary portion of motherhood where that resilience really comes in, because no one cares if you need a break or a timeout for yourself. They're just going to keep going. It's either the best test or the worst test in life. So what I'm hoping you can share with us, Melanie, is in that prenatal state, even before necessarily conception has taken place, or maybe you're already pregnant, what are you recommending women are doing? There's certainly that mindfulness piece, but can we talk about some tangible elements of health that women can be aware of that is going to be a game changer on the other side?
Yeah, 100%. One of the things that I love to discuss with women is that pregnancy, unless otherwise defined, is not a state of fragility. There's this idea that pregnancy is almost pathological, and we talk about it in those terms, but there's no reason for that to be. So in the absence of major contraindications or complications, one of the best things that women can be doing is moving with either a moderate or vigorous intensity. And you know, we've all been that woman or known that woman who's like, I'm pregnant. I'm gonna put my feet up for 10 months. I'm gonna eat McFlurries because somebody told me I should rest. And while I'm not against rest, the actual recommendation from the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists of Canada is that you should be getting a minimum of 150 minutes a week, ideally 30 minutes a day. And in an ideal situation, minimum 30 minutes a day, every day if you can, of moderate to vigorous. So something that's significantly elevating your heart rate. And, you know, women need to know that this is safe. We used to think, oh, I don't want to move too much because it's going to heat up the baby. There are studies now that you could literally be working out in the Bahamas for 45 minutes at high intensity, and the likelihood of it actually causing harm to the baby is next to nothing. So that's not really, it's a bit of an outdated parameter. So movement is one thing. And I always recommend to women, if you're new to fitness, find ways that you can fit it in the cracks of your day. So it might be as simple as taking the stairs instead of the elevator. But for those women who are already fit, don't feel like you need to give that up. If you were a marathon runner beforehand, you can still run. It is safe, unless your doctor has told you otherwise. Continue to be fit and support yourself in those ways. Another big one is please see a pelvic floor therapist. I cannot stress this enough. You can't make decisions for your body when you don't know the state of your body. Mm-hmm. And really interestingly, for years, we just used to tell women to Kegel. But now as we see a higher prevalence of women who are affected by chronic stress, who have underlying symptoms of depression or anxiety, or just have a natural tendency towards a higher muscle tone, things like Kegels are not an appropriate exercise. But the only way you can tell that, the gold standard, is to have an internal. So I really feel like just the same way your doula or your midwife are part of your birthing team, your pelvic health physio should be there prenatally. Because if you're just randomly DIYing it, then you're actually doing exercises that could potentially be harmful to you. You want to have a really good understanding, because some women, Kegels are going to be a really important part of their journey. And for other people, they're really going to want to focus on lengthening and mobility. So those are two really big ones that I always stress. And then I think the last one, and this is not just for women, mothers, pregnancy, is I really fundamentally believe that anybody who wants to have a bigger impact, who wants to do things significant in their life, needs to have a mindfulness practice. I just think there are too many things that set our nervous system off, and we're in this perpetual fight or flight. And I think everybody needs to put aside the fact that it was once woo-woo and needs to now, you know, come around to having some sort of mindfulness practice that resonates with them. So the studies have shown, in order to downregulate our nervous system, there's some really great things we can be doing, whether it's Tai Chi, Qigong, whether it's forest bathing, which for us urban dwellers, I just think is a fancy word for getting outside, whether it's yoga, whether it's deep breathing, whether it's meditation. You don't have to love all of them, but find one that resonates with you and your lifestyle. And I think you'll be so pleasantly surprised to see the impact that it has.
Yeah, it is so key. And it's a conversation over and over and over again that comes up, regardless of people's discipline. I'm like, what is your favorite thing that you do that elevates your performance? And it's mindfulness. And what's so interesting is it looks different for everybody. Mm-hmm. So there isn't one way of doing it. It's not sitting in necessarily on a cushion in the corner of your room and trying not to think of anything. That's like getting up today and running a marathon as it pertains to the mindfulness meditation movement. But we had a guest on 2 weeks ago, Dr. Romy Mushtak. She's a triple board certified neurologist.
Amazing.
And she was like, you've got to do mindfulness. Like we just see the difference, and her focus is epilepsy. And she's like, we just see the difference in people's brains when you engage in a mindfulness practice. Why are we taking medication to manage our stress, or drinking half a bottle of wine every night to manage our stress, in the absence of this tool that is available for free to all of us? So it's such critical advice. And I'm just so glad that you're reiterating that piece for everybody.
Yeah, I think when people see the science behind it, it's really hard to find any reason not to do it. I just read Emily Fletcher's book on Ziva meditation. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it increases the neurons between the right and left side of the brain. The fact that it has these major clinical outcomes, like honestly, and we know this in practice, like more and more we've been delving into this with all of our patients. It's something that you need to do that's accessible to everybody and has got to be almost as important as drinking the damn water or eating your vegetables.
What's the relationship between mindfulness practices and the tone or strength of someone's pelvic floor?
Yeah, so I often explain this in terms of a headache, because everybody can understand that when they're stressed, they literally can feel their shoulders creeping up towards their ears, right? Like, it's not uncommon at all when people say, oh my God, I've got a tension headache, or I can feel it in my shoulders. Like, I desperately need a massage. I've been so stressed. What people fail to remember is that your pelvic floor is simply a muscle. It's not any more special than any other muscle in the body, and it's equally susceptible to tone created by stress, anxiety, all of those things, because what's happening is your nervous system is firing at a higher rate, creating more tonicity in those muscles. So a couple of things happen when we have a mindfulness practice. One, it's often associated with breath, which means that we're oxygenating those muscles again, which when we don't, it's kind of like you're doing a constant workout, right? We're holding them under tension and we're developing lactic acid. When we start to breathe, they actually get to relax. We start to dissipate some of those other things like the lactic acid, and they start to ease off a little bit. But probably more importantly is we change that firing rate. So we don't relieve it simply with mindfulness. We do need a stretching and sometimes a manual practice to go with it. But the mindfulness is key because I can stretch out somebody's pelvic floor and they can do all the home stretches in the world. But if their nervous system is consistently sending them messaging that those muscles need to be tight, you're going to stretch for years before you actually see a positive outcome. You need to change both the neural system and the muscular system.
I love that. What about the connection between our pelvic floor and health in general? In particular, our skeletal health, because I feel like this is an area people have chronic low back pain forever, and ultimately it's connected to that, to the pelvic floor. And this is an area we just kind of, we never talked about, we never acknowledged previously.
Yeah, Dr. Sinead Dufour, who's one of the leading scientists in pelvic health, did a study where she looked at everybody who went into a clinic with complaints of back or hip pain. None of them mentioned pelvic floor pain or any pelvic floor dysfunction when they came in. And what they found of those people after thorough examination is that 96% of people with hip or back pain had some type of pelvic floor dysfunction, which is huge. That's a massive number, right? But because we're not having the conversation, a lot of people weren't actually thinking about pelvic floor. So what we know now is it's got a huge component. It's the bottom of the canister for our core. So it helps to keep really good spinal alignment. It helps to support your internal organs. And it's really key in creating this intra-abdominal pressure that keeps our spine where it should be when we do load-bearing activities. So as soon as there's dysfunction, either too tight, creating too much pressure, or too loose, you lose a lot of that component of good alignment and proper mechanics when we're trying to do functional things in our day.
I love that. Do you recommend everyone have their pelvic floor assessed? Is this something that is exclusive to women? Like women are like, my husband has back problems. Should he have his pelvic floor assessed? What does that look like? What is the indication around that piece?
Yeah, listen, I'm a pelvic health therapist, so I'm obviously biased on this one. But you bring up a good point, which is I think most of our prenatal population now knows that they need to have a pelvic floor assessment. But really, when we're looking at those numbers of 96%, there are a lot of clients, men included, who could really, really benefit from this. And like, we know how disabling back pain is, but it's not just that. It's people with painful periods, people with sexual dysfunction, people with chronic illness. All of those can be contributed to pelvic floor. So obviously I'm biased. I think everybody should have the assessment. I get that it's a little bit awkward for people, but you know what's really awkward? Peeing your pants for 10 years or not living the life you want, chasing after your kids because you've had crippling back pain for 10 years. So I just need the world to get over themselves. Just do it. And then we can come up with a plan so people can go back to participating in the lives that they really love and enjoy.
I love Melanie's mission here. The world just needs to get over themselves and actually just have a higher quality life experience because you just deal with the problem head on. And, you know, as clinicians, it's so interesting because people get, there's this reticence about talking about digestive health or going to see your pelvic floor physio. But when you're the clinician, you're like, I do this all, I live for this. I love this. Like this is because it's so liberating and helpful for people. So, you know, you're not going to your neighbor for help. You're going to the person who is like, trained and in a perfect capacity to be able to assist you with it. I love that you said that.
And I will tell you, I never had any intention of this being the work that I did. Like, honestly, I'm sure the sentence came out of my mouth, you could not pay me enough money. I didn't think I'd be looking at people's business all day long. But the work is transformative. I gave up working with elite and professional athletes because I saw more value in this work in how people participate in their lives and how it can really give back a sense of wholeness to people. So from somebody who didn't even want to go there to someone who's preaching it from the rooftops, like it is a really important aspect of health.
I love that. And I feel like this is a perfect place to transition the nature of our questions in this interview to a section that I call our KPIs. So just like we have them in our business, I believe that we have them in how we live our lives as well. So I've got a few 2021 version of rapid fire questions for you.
Okay, let's go for it.
First one, what is your most recommended book of all time?
Like I said, I've been reading up a storm in 2021. It's like there's nothing to do and I'm trying to escape from my family.
I know nothing about that.
I'm a big Brené Brown fan. And I think braving the wilderness is incredibly important in just making people understand the value in sharing their vulnerabilities, but also leading from a place of authenticity and strength. That's a big one that's been on my list this past year.
Love it. What is your favorite health hack?
I really love tech. I'm one of those people who really likes to see my outcomes. I'm the person who finishes her Peloton and needs to go to the challenges part to see how many minutes I've got accumulated. So I think for me, it's anything that is measurable because we can't manage our health if we can't measure it. So whether it's as simple as, you know, a checklist, or for me, I love my Apple Watch. I love my Aura Ring. I love things that tell me sort of what the state of my body is. Anything that's measurable that gives you momentum and accountability is something that I'm really suggesting to all my clients these days.
How would you define your purpose?
Ooh, how would I define my purpose? I think my purpose these days has really been to give a voice to issues that people have been afraid to talk about, because I really believe women especially are the custodians of health. But when we don't offer them a safe place to talk about what they need to without shame, without guilt, we diminish their health experience. So for me, having those conversations means giving them the opportunity to not just up-level their health and wellness, but to up-level the health and wellness of our entire community.
Amazing. And last question for you, Melanie. Entrepreneurism, are we born this way or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
I think it's a little bit of both. In my journey, I've done a lot of learning. And probably had you asked me 10 years ago if I would be a business owner and be chasing down all these crazy things, I probably would have looked at you like you were crazy. But I think there's always been an undercurrent in my life that has wanted something of my own, that wanted to chase down big dreams and was never really satisfied just working for somebody else. So I think in my case, the undercurrent and the emotion of entrepreneurship has always been there, but the learning has also been something that has made the journey much more feasible.
Amazing. Melanie Sutherland, up to so many great things, such a strong advocate for women. Where can we send people to learn more about the work that you are up to? And we'll stick all of this in our show notes.
Absolutely. So probably the best place, because we're always launching new things, creating new things these days. I have a business coach that makes me do all that stuff. But is probably over on social media, on Instagram at BodyCo, BODYCO Toronto. And that's where you can find all the great things we're doing, not just in clinic, but online and in our community.
Melanie, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much, Megan. I appreciate the opportunity.
Anthropology is the study and science of what makes entrepreneurs tick. It's the confluence of the mindset, strategic thinking, and health that we bring to the table as individuals compelled to create and contribute in this world. You know, it's a lonely place to be at the top. It's a lonely place to feel like you are different, which is why we have our Anthropology Collective, a free Facebook group where women just like you gather to explore the ideas, philosophy, health, optimization, and the notion of purpose that we bring to our lives. The Anthropology Collective is open to anyone. You can find us on Facebook, and it's where people just like you are going to be hanging. Until next week, live life on, in, and with purpose. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker, and I will talk to you soon.